The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, the hidden history of beer in Ireland, from medieval monasteries right up to the 20th century. And coming up a little later, how the First World War affected the newly established National University of Ireland.
There are 914 men listed on the NUI Roll of Honour. Every one of them had everything to lose by participating in the war.
At the time, these women, they believed that what they were doing was important, that they were contributing what they could in a time of crisis.
We'll hear stories of the men and women, NUI students, graduates and staff, who went to war. For thousands of years, beer has been central to Irish life, from the time when it was brewed in monasteries. It's been woven into social rituals, used to mark births, deaths and pretty much everything in between. People have gathered over a beer for millennia, and as we're about to hear, this practice offers a unique perspective on our history. Filthy Queens, A History of Beer in Ireland, is a new book which uncovers Ireland's brewing past. In particular, it explores the vital role of women in the trade. The author is Dr. Christina Wade, who joins me in studio. Christina, you're very welcome to The History Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're a professional beer historian, and there are listeners who are saying to themselves, now that's a job I would love. How did you manage to stagger into this particular specialty?
So I moved to Ireland in 2011 to do my master's at Trinity College in medieval history, and then stayed for my doctorate. And during the course of my doctorate, my amazing supervisor basically told me to get a hobby.
Get a life.
That academia can be hard. And so I needed something, another basket to put eggs in, basically. So I started the Ladies Craft Beer Society of Ireland in 2013, hoping to get a couple of friends out of it. And now we're at about 1,400 members from six different continents all over the world.
So you got a book out of it and you got quite a few friends from the sound of it. Why do you think that beer is a good medium for exploring the past in Ireland and presumably elsewhere as well?
For many reasons, one of which is its familiarity to us. I think even if you don't drink beer, you are familiar with the pint. You know, having a pint with friends, you can see other people engaging with it. And so when we look at the historical documents and we see someone, you know, 500, 600, 700 years ago talking about the joys of having a pint with friends in a pub, or my particular favorite, the Triads of Ireland, talking about one of life's delights is, you know, a hot bath and a beer. And I think many of us maybe on a cold winter's day can relate. So I think it's something that makes the past not so foreign to us. We can relate to it through that.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, people drank beer thousands or hundreds of years ago and we're still doing it. Now, there's a particular focus, as I mentioned, on women in the book. And let's go back to, I don't know, what, 5th century, I suppose, or possibly even prehistory, depending on what your attitude is or where you stand on who St. Bridget might or might not have been. But you do suggest that she probably was involved in the brewing of ale.
Yes. So my first chapter, a saint, a goddess, and a nun walk into a brewery, essentially, because she is associated with so many stories around miraculous brew days. One of the most famous is her Easter miracle ale, when out of one bag of malt, she's able to make all this ale for all of these, you know, surrounding neighborhoods and churches for so many days. And, you know, she also has stories of turning water that had been prepared for bathwater into ale, or many other things of that nature.
And does this all come from Cogitosis, who was writing her biography, I think, about 100 years or so after the time of her existence?
So a lot of it comes from his original work. And then we also see in her later saints' lives, similar stories reappearing. But we can also look at the archaeology from monastic communities in the medieval period and see that we have nuns brewing and brew houses on nunneries and other monastic communities.
Has anybody ever tried to reproduce what they were brewing?
Yes. So there have been some amazing experimental archaeology projects, one from the 16th century, but there have been Maybe some more on the way. I've made a medieval small ale myself from years ago, but I would like to look at the account rolls from Christchurch and work at recreating a medieval ale from those records.
And what proof was the medieval ale that you produced yourself?
The one that I produced myself was actually from English records. So it was a recipe that someone had already made years ago, and I worked on recreating it myself and then turning into a braggot. But the one I want to make from the account rolls in Christchurch is basically simply based on what the grains that they used to brew. So they say, you know, we need this amount malt, this amount of this kind of malt, this amount of this kind of malt, because, you know, someone is coming or things like that. And so from then we have to create a recipe.
But was your brew nice and strong?
It wasn't. I specifically made the small ale because I knew I was going to turn it into a braggot. So it was about 1.5%.
Sorry, what's a braggot?
Oh, right. Good question. So a braggot is when you take an already made ale and then you add honey and spices to it and allow it to re-ferment.
So it's kind of like fortifying it in a way.
Yes.
Okay, interesting. Now, early medieval Ireland, the social structure is based on gift giving. And this is one of the places where alcohol plays a major part, isn't it?
Yes. So lots of scholars have argued that it's really important that people engage in gift exchange and rituals of power. So someone who is higher up would give gifts to the people underneath them, and the people underneath them would reciprocate by giving gifts to the higher person. And this is in large quantities. So in the Bill of Rights, we see certain people are entitled to amounts of ale feasts or drinking horns, but also on a micro level where we see that the person who is the highest ranking man in the hall drinks first and everybody drinks after them, you know, acknowledging their power.
The Vikings then arrive, and presumably did they bring Carlsberg with them or no, probably not. The Vikings arrive and they have that much, I suppose, at least in common with the Irish, that both are beer drinkers.
Yes, it was actually one of the ways that they could mix and blend their cultures. So they had very similar rituals of power. We just talked about that concept of the higher status person drinking and everyone after them drinking as acknowledgement of their power. And this is something we also see in Viking society. We see them also feasting and having ale as an important part of the feasting ritual. So this was a way that they could understand each other, that they could speak to each other through a medium that they could both relate to. So it was a really important way that they could blend their cultures.
Now, it is a myth that the Vikings had horns in their helmets, but you do write quite extensively about the horn as a vessel for drinking. How important was it?
Yes. So this is one of the interesting topics that I really liked to dive into, because we can see that high status or high valued drinking apparatus were actually a really important part of the culture of gift exchange, so much so that certain kings were entitled to a number of these important high ranking drinking horns. Now, some of them were more ornate with different designs or metals, and, you know, added to them at the top and at the bottom. And others were a little bit more basic. But then at the end of the day, these were in general very high status drinking vessels.
And the Black Death, which comes at the end of the 14th century, did that have any major impact on beer drinking? It certainly had a major impact on the levels of population, that's for sure.
Yes. So when we look at brewing and beer in Ireland, unlike other places, for example, in England, after the Black Death, it was one of the major factors that kicked off this massive commercialization of brewing. We don't see the same thing in Ireland. In fact, the Black Death had a very different impact on the culture of brewing here.
Why does it kick off brewing in Britain or in England?
So what happens after the Black Death is that the people that were left were in a better financial position. So they had access to resources that their ancestors didn't. They had a better quality of life. And people tried to stop that. And so we see things like the Peasants' Revolt. But they drank more ale than their predecessors had. And so then ale became more valuable and a more interesting thing to do, more financially viable. And so men became more interested. Now, it wasn't just the Black Death. There are other factors like the rise of guilds and the use of hops and industrialization in and of itself. But the Black Death is a factor in England.
And why is it not a factor so much in Ireland?
So in Ireland, we don't actually see that the people that were left behind having this amazing quality of life and drinking more. So it's quite different, which allows women to brew much longer than they brewed in other places.
Now, OK, well, that brings me to the title of the book, Filthy Queens. Where does that come from?
Filthy Queens is one of my favorite anecdotes in the book. In 1610, a man by the name of Barnaby Rich, who had no qualifications on the matter, decided he was going to write a book called A New Description of Ireland. Now, Barnaby was an English army captain who decided to spend his twilight years in Dublin. And this book is an incredibly biased account. He was a very prejudiced man. And amongst his many diatribes, he has a go at the alewives of Dublin and calls them, amongst other things, most filthy queens. Now, in other places, we know that people were writing not so nice things about alewives. Similarly, they would write not so nice things about millers or bakers. But alewives had a healthy dose of misogyny on top of that. But in Ireland, this was not well received. In fact, Barnaby had to write an apology a couple years later in which he essentially said, oh, I wasn't talking about the good housewives. You know, brewing is an important part of housewifery. I was talking about the bad sort of brewers, the ones over here. Now, I will say that I have read both books and Barnaby was not making any differentiation between the two. So he's trying to, you know, dig himself out of a hole here. But one wonders exactly how frosty the reception of his first book must have been that he had to write this apology.
And what exactly was an alewife, good or bad or indifferent even?
So in the context, what Barnaby's talking about is women who were brewing and selling ale.
And this was the norm, was it?
It seems to be. So Barnaby says that every householder's wife is a brewer and that they all fancy themselves tavern keepers. Now, we know Barnaby's probably exaggerating, so we have to look at the other resources. So we look at the legal cases and the laws, and we can see from that there's actually probably quite a few women who are brewing in Dublin, and it kind of holds up.
And what kind of brews did they have back in medieval Ireland? And how similar would they be to the kind of brews that we have now?
Right. So if we're talking about pre-hopped, so hops sort of enter the field in the 16th century in Ireland. So if we're talking about pre-hopped ales, we're talking about sort of a malt-based beverage, which would be just different grains. So barley, rye, wheat, something called hastival, which is an early ripening grain, these sorts of things. But we could also add herbs. However, that might not necessarily be part of the brewing process as such. They could be added later or to your own specifications. So really the basis, what we're talking about, is this sort of non-hopped, grain-based malt beverage. And it might be something that wasn't actually boiled at all. So something that we would call a raw ale today.
And what would be the equivalent of the normal kind of ales or normal kind of brews that people would have been drinking? What would be the modern equivalent, the closest that we have today?
That's a very good question. It's hard to answer that, particularly when we're talking about non-hopped ales, because most of the brews that we talk about in our modern era, all craft beers and things like, are using hops. So we would have to remove that from the equation. Now, we see some breweries recreating old style ales like Gruitt's or with heather. Those things are probably more equivalent than anything you're getting at the shop.
Now, back to the alewives and something that they are associated with willy-nilly, and that is witchcraft. Was that the case? Were alewives, did alewives tend to be witches and vice versa?
Yes, that's an absolute myth. So I'll talk about an Irish context, but it's also a myth in a UK context. So in Ireland, we had actually very, very few witchcraft trials. Certainly not enough to make any representative case study that witches were somehow associated with alewives. But I did look at the witch trials in Ireland, and there just isn't a link. So women who brewed were not viewed as being associated with malicious witchcraft. That just isn't the case. It seems like it might be true because we see, for example, in England, women painted in hell. These alewives are painted in hell. They're associated with marrying demons. But they did the same thing to millers and bakers. There was this overall sort of suspicion of anyone who was selling food or drink. So alewives weren't immune to that, but there was also this healthy dose of misogyny. But when you look at the actual cases, the witchcraft trials, the witch pamphlets, all of these things together, it just does not play out. In fact, you find people who were accused of witchcraft accused of ruining other women's brews and things of that nature. So it just simply isn't true.
And were there many witch trials back in those days in the 17th century?
In Ireland, very, very, very few. Very, very few. In Wales, very few. In England, we're looking at the average about 2.5 a year. And then Scotland has quite a few. So Scotland is a completely different case.
Okay. You've a chapter called The Devil in the Alehouse. And you go into the role of beer in the 1641 rebellion. So do brews feature in the infamous 1641 depositions?
Yes. So ale and beer are very prevalent here. And I'm talking about both and their different brews. So beer here, talking about the hopped beverage. And ale could also have hops, but it's viewed distinctly here. They're not using them as intertwined words. We see that the armies of both the Irish and the English run on ale. They are demanding ale, they're demanding beer, they're stealing brewing equipment, not only because it's valuable, but also to brew. There's a case of a woman, actually, who was forced at sword point to brew ale for the Irish. And so we can see that ale, the armies on both sides were, in fact, running on beer and ale.
So you're telling me that Cromwell's soldier, because we're after 1641, obviously a few years afterwards, Cromwell arrives. Was that still the case? Cromwell's puritanical soldiers were demanding ale?
See, ale has always been a really important part of diet. It's something that we find across the board with armies. It's something that we know from the medieval armies they ran on it. Even letters from the Chancery, the Justiciary, back in the early medieval, we see that they're exporting Irish grain to England, to then Scotland, to brew ale for the English army to fight against the Scottish army.
And is this calorie count, basically?
It can be. It's also simply because people enjoyed it. But yeah, it was an important part of nutrition and a part of diet.
So it's like the 19th century Rome ration, I suppose. This is part of how you keep an army on its feet or on its toes.
Mm.
Irish porter, the pint of plain. The pint of plain is your only man. Irish porter becomes associated with patriotism. When and why?
So Irish porter, in a chapter I've aptly called The Porter Wars, Irish porter is sort of pitted against English porter, because in the 17th century, we have a lot of English porter being imported into Ireland. And so we see a rise of these Irish breweries making Irish porter and talking about their amazing own brews, to the point where they start associating drinking Irish porter with being a patriot, with being, you know, for Ireland and supporting, you know, the cause of Ireland. And we see that in newspapers. We see that in stories. We even see that in the memoirs of Peg Plunkett, one of the most famous courtesans to ever exist. And it becomes quite common, and it spills over into the 19th century, where we start seeing, you know, the likes of Daniel O'Connell being associated. His son ran the Phoenix Brewery. To the point where he had to actually distance himself from the brewery. He had to come out and say that he wasn't associated with the brewery, because people were quite unnerved about his association with the Phoenix Porter Brewery, when his rival, of course, was Guinness. So we also see, you know, breweries taking up the collection for Daniel O'Connell. So it's very much associated with not only Irish patriotism, but Catholic emancipation.
And how important economically is the brewing industry in Ireland in the 19th century?
Very important. The 19th century is very particularly interesting, because we start with many different breweries, small breweries in rural communities and the like, though they start to shut down. And they quite a few shut down, of course, during the course of the famine. But then at the end of the 19th century, we see the rise of these massive commercial breweries. Like Guinness, for example, was about 42 acres, according to Alfred Bernard, who did his famous investigation of the breweries of Ireland. So we're talking, I mean, they had their own trains, they had their own, you know, boat fleet. We're talking about these massive breweries. And that's a huge difference from the sort of large, but not anywhere near that large breweries we start the century with.
And is that macro brewing why women are pushed out of the trade?
I think it has something huge to do with it, though I will say that women still inherited breweries from their husbands. So when their husbands would pass, a lot of time the women would then take over. We see that with Deasy and Co., for example. And then she passed then the brewery to her daughters. But at the end of it, they're not necessarily the ones doing the actual labor of brewing. So they're owning the brewery. And that's quite different than doing the labor itself. But certainly by the end of the 19th century and the 20th century, we don't see very many women anymore brewing.
Personal question to finish off with. You are not just an historian of beer, you are a brewer yourself. You have made butter beer. Until now, I was unaware that that was something that was outside of the imagination of J.K. Rowling. It's not just a Harry Potter thing. Butter beer exists or existed?
Yeah, so butter beer is very much a real thing. It was a very popular drink, 15th, 16th century, and it's a hot malted, you know, hot beer drink. So you like your, you know, your hot wine drinks, your mulled wine, and it's similar. So with the addition of butter and spices, and it's a nice warming drink over, you know, maybe the Christmas holiday season.
Give it a try. The book is called Filthy Queens, A History of Beer in Ireland. It's published by Nine Bean Rows. The author is my guest, Dr. Christina Wade. Christina, many thanks indeed for joining us on The History Show.
Thank you so much.
And after the break, how the First World War affected the students and the staff of the National University of Ireland. Stay with us.
The History Show with Miles Dungan on RTE Radio 1.
For much of the 20th century, the Irish men and women who served in the British forces during the First World War were largely absent from public memory in this country. Some who joined up saw it as a professional opportunity. And of course, many of those who fought did so believing that they were helping to secure home rule for Ireland. But as Ireland moved towards independence, their stories were written out of Irish history. Among them were many students, graduates and staff of the National University of Ireland, at that time constituting UCD, UCC and UCG, now the University of Galway. In 1919, the NUI published a roll of honour listing those who had fought or died in the war. A recently published book expands on this roll of honour with fresh research and profiles of these individuals, exploring the role of medical graduates, chaplains and also the women who took part in the war effort. The book is called The National University of Ireland, First World War Centenary, Roll of Honour and Essays. I'm joined now in studio by the editors, journalist Ronan McGreevy and NUI Publications Manager Eimear Purcell. You're both very welcome indeed to the programme.
Thank you,
Eimear, it's been in development, this book, for quite a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it took a while. We started thinking about having it ready for the actual centenary in 2018. We contacted Ronan at that time to ask him. He had just published his Where the Firing Line Extends. And we invited Ronan to write. The idea was that he would write an introduction and we would just republish the honour roll. And then when Ronan came on board, he said, well, why don't I write some profiles and give more depth and background to these men? Then we decided, well, we wanted to honour our NUI women as well. So we invited Fionnuala Walsh to write a chapter on graduate women who had contributed to the war effort as well, just to have that balance. So it kind of kept growing arms and legs, for want of a better way of describing it. And we knew that Joe Deignan, Patrick Casey and Kevin Cullen had produced a book on Irish doctors who participated in World War One. So they were a natural choice then to contribute a chapter on NUI doctors who participated in the war, which they kindly agreed to do. They also included an awful lot of material on the advances that were made in medicine during the war and administering to those who were sick and injured at the war front. And then the last piece of the puzzle was Barbara McCormick. We found out about Barbara McCormick's work looking at the chaplains from Maynooth College, from St. Patrick's. So that's kind of how it grew as time went on. And then we kind of had other projects of part of our Decade of Centenary programme kind of leapfrogged over it. We had the pandemic. So it was a few years in the making, yeah. And probably could have been a few more actually as well if I'd had my way. But anyway.
Well, it's here now.
Yeah.
Ronan, talk to us a little bit about education, university education in Ireland at that time, because we had, and you mentioned it in the book, we obviously had the land question, we had the national question, we also had the universities question.
Well, the universities question was a very important question that's kind of been forgotten about. As you know, you've written a book yourself about the land question and the national question. The third thing was to have a Catholic counterpoint to Trinity College Dublin, which was the dominant university on the island in the 19th century. There was a feeling that that there was no Catholic alternative to this. And this was an issue that in 1845, the universities, or in that decade, the famine decade, the universities of Queen's College, Cork, Galway and Belfast were
the godless colleges.
Yes, the godless college.
As far as O'Connell was concerned.
Yes, they were, but they were regarded as being not endowed by the Anglican faith. This issue rumbled on throughout the 19th century. UCD was founded in the 1850s, and there was a feeling still that there was no coherent Catholic university for the nationalist majority, particularly as in the late 1870s and 1880s, the issue of secondary school education for well-off Catholics became more predominant, and obviously there was more demand for universities as well. So it all culminated in 1908 with the National Universities, with the Universities Act, which is regarded as one of the sort of signature kind of achievements of the Irish Party in those years between 1900 and 1914. In which they became fully fledged universities, UCD, UCC, and UCG. So they became a sort of a Catholic counterpoint, as I said, to Trinity College. And it's in that context that the Act was only 6 years old when the war itself broke out.
And how then did the National University of Ireland respond to the war?
Well, it responded as most middle-class Catholic Ireland did at that time, which was to support the British war effort. There was a lot of consternation at that time about the Rape of Belgium, as it was called, particularly in August 1914 with the burning down of the library in Louvain. Louvain had an Irish college going back to the 16th century. So this is something that educated people in Ireland felt very strongly about it. But all the three universities involved were, and the NUI, which was the governing body, were four square behind the British war effort. Students who agreed to participate in it were given leave of absence from their studies and they were allowed to take up their degrees afterwards. So it was, for most of the war's duration, the NUI supported the British war effort, and as evidenced by the fact that also in 1919 they published a Roll of Honour.
Now, James Connolly refers to economic conscription during the First World War. Obviously, conscription didn't apply to Ireland, but what he's referring to is people who basically literally couldn't afford not to go to war. That wasn't the pattern of the enlistment from University College Dublin, Cork and Galway, was it?
No, this is true. And there are 914 men listed on the NUI Roll of Honour. Every one of them had everything to lose by participating in the war. Remember, there was no conscription in Ireland. They didn't need to go. They were leaving behind, you know, their studies. A lot of them were medical students, etc., etc. But they signed up anyway. And I think they are evidence that we can't just lazily state, well, you know, all the people from nationalist background who joined up were joined up because, you know, for the money. Because in this case, they were actually risking everything, including their lives, to participate in the war.
And they would have had difficulty, or they did have difficulty, in getting commissions. You would expect that a university graduate or an undergraduate would have at least some opportunity to become at least a lieutenant in World War One.
Well, at that time, it's hard to envisage now, but only a small percentage of people actually ended up with a secondary school education. I think in the 1911 census in the UK, which included Ireland, it was something like 6 or 7%. So having had a secondary school education would have been regarded, you would have been regarded in the UK in general as being officer material. But that didn't happen in Ireland. The UVF, those who had been officers in the UVF when the 36th Ulster Division was formed, they became officer material. But that did not happen in Ireland for a long, long time. So some of those involved who had even university education had to enlist as privates to become non-commissioned officers as opposed to commissioned officers. And that was down to a belief widespread in Nationalist Ireland that National Asylum was simply not trusted by the British authorities.
And one of the people who was, I think, most vehement about this was the officer commanding the 16th Irish Division, and that was General Parsons.
Yes, he was somebody who was regarded as a rather bumptious individual who, despite claiming everywhere he was asked that he was Irish and understood the country very well, in fact, he didn't. And he created an awful lot of difficulties for John Redmond in particular, who had risked his neck, as we know, to support the British war effort.
Now, Emer, you, along with John Foley, curate some of the NUI archival material in the book, and one letter that you have is from Arthur Beveridge, who served in the Royal Army Medical Corps. And we'll talk to Ronan a little bit later about why there are so many. When you look at this list, RAMC, RAMC, nearly almost every second one, and sometimes three or four in succession. Tell me about Arthur Beveridge.
Well, Arthur Beveridge was from Rathgar in Dublin, and his dad was town clerk of Dublin. He had a twin brother, James, who also served in the war, but unfortunately he was killed in 1917, which, you know, brings home the personal aspect of the war and impact on families, which we tend to forget in the broader scheme of things. In NUI, we have the NUI archive, and we also hold the archive of the Royal University of Ireland as well. So in that material, we've actually found a letter from Arthur Beveridge, and he's writing to see if he can be awarded an honorary degree, an honorary science degree. So it's lovely to see those threads we have.
So he wasn't going to come back and finish his degree?
No, he's looking for an exemption to be awarded that. And a lot of the time they will cite their experience in the war. They'll cite the medical experience that they gained in that as well. And we have record, you know, he's listed as one of the ones for UCD who is awarded. They did give it to him, his BSc. So you see those threads coming through, which is one of the most interesting things about the project. These men mentioned in the honour roll, then we're finding evidence of them in our own archive as well. It was a lot.
Mm. And why were there so many, Ronan? Why so many NUI doctors becoming medics in World War One?
Because there was an oversupply of doctors in Ireland. I think there was over 3,000 Irish doctors who served in the First World War. I would imagine that's close enough to a majority of them. The Irish had a long service, long history of service, both in the British Armed Forces, but also in the Empire. So there's an awful lot of doctors who are listed here who would have served in places like India over the decades. And there was an oversupply of doctors for Ireland. And for a lot of them, it was simply a career opportunity. It was a good place to get experience. There was some adventure involved in it and all the rest of that. And the opportunities at home for a lot of them was very limited.
And of course, some of them didn't come back.
That's right.
Now, the names on the NUI's Roll of Honour, as first published in 1919, are all men, but many NUI women were also involved in the war. A chapter by Dr. Fionnuala Walsh looks into the lives of these women and their contribution to the war effort. Earlier, she spoke to our producer, Lorcan Clancy.
For a long time, these women, their stories were neglected and dismissed as being unimportant and secondary to everything else that was happening in Ireland at this time. But for thousands of women, the war had a very significant impact on their lives, not just in what they did at the time, but also in its transformative effects for decades afterwards.
When the war first broke out in 1914, the most common response here was support for the British war effort. Irish men had to decide whether or not they wanted to join the armed forces.
But women also had decisions to make and had to choose to what extent they were going to get involved and what the war might mean for their studies, for their opportunities in the years ahead.
Of course, not all women agreed on how to respond to the war. The suffrage movement, which included many women involved in universities, was divided. The Irish Women's Franchise League, for example, felt that the fight for voting rights should come first.
They published front covers saying, "Votes for women now, damn your war." While other suffragists felt strongly that the war was a crisis and that women had to do their bit to prove their worth as citizens by getting involved in Red Cross work or other activities to support wounded soldiers.
On the home front, women also had to step into various professions to replace absent men. Of course, those pursuing higher education could apply what they learned in fields like medicine.
And there was a lot of conversation at the time, a lot of discourse in the media about how women were on the upward move, that this was women's moment. The women were proving their work as citizens and that things could only get better for them. There's also the added element of the fact that as men were killed in the war, increasingly women had to consider a life without perhaps a spouse and to consider how they might make their own way in the world through their own financial means. And so education was an alternative route to perhaps to marriage and motherhood. The women who were students and graduates from the NUI at this time are very much exceptional women, a minority of women in Ireland at the time who had the opportunity to go on to third level. The numbers are growing, however, throughout this time. From 1908, once the National University of Ireland was established, women were admitted on equal terms with men. So, you know, within a period of 10 years, things are changing quite significantly for women. And these are, I suppose, among the earliest of the women graduates who are trying to make their way in the world as well after their studies.
Fionnuala Walsh has written extensively on the subject of Irish women and the Great War. She authored a book on the subject in 2020, but narrowing the focus to the NUI revealed some notable individuals. Of the 100 honorary war degrees conferred by the NUI, only two were awarded to women. They were both at UCC, Ellen Casey, a scientific assistant in the munitions department, and Iris Cummins, an engineer who took up munitions work at the Royal Arsenal in London.
And then after the war in 1927, she becomes the first woman admitted to the Institution of Civil Engineers in Ireland. So these are women who are very much using what they learned in their time in university to support their war work. Alice Perry is another engineering example. So she was in Galway, and she was the first woman in either Ireland or Britain to qualify as an engineer. And during the war, she served as a factory inspector in England and in Scotland. And this was increasingly important work due to the very dangerous nature of munitions work. Emily Anderson is another interesting woman from this time. So she graduated from Queen's College Galway in 1911, and she served throughout the war on the committee of the Galway Depot of the Irish War Hospital Supply Depot. And this is an organisation that gathered sphagnum moss from Irish bogland and made it into bandages. Due to the shortage of cotton wool, this became increasingly urgent as the war went on. And she was very active on the home front in that activity right up to 1918. And she became a professor of German in Galway in 1917, taking on a very senior position. But in 1920, she moved to London to work for the British Foreign Office. And in 1944, she received an OBE for her service during World War II.
While these two women, Emily Anderson and Alice Perry, don't appear on the Roll of Honour, they are honoured today at the University of Galway, with two buildings named after them in 2017, the Alice Perry Engineering Building and the Emily Anderson Concert Hall.
At the time, these women, they believed that what they were doing was important and that they were contributing what they could in a time of crisis. And they believed that they would be remembered for doing so. And I think it's about time that we give due recognition to their work.
And that was Dr. Fionnuala Walsh ending that report on NUI women and the First World War. Ronan McGreevy and Eimear Purcell are still with me here in studio. Eimear, there's also a chapter in the book on the Maynooth chaplains who studied at Ireland's National Seminary, one of whom inspired the cover of the book. Just tell us a little bit about the Irish chaplains in World War I who would have come through NUI.
Yeah, Barbara McCormick did great work. I think for the first time she brought together a list of approximately 60 graduates of St. Patrick's College in Maynooth who would have served in the war. Most of these men may have had some affiliation with some of the other constituent colleges of NUI and that they would have done their initial degrees there. One very interesting one, as you mentioned there, was Father Gleeson, who's from a Tipperary man. They would have ministered to the Irish Catholic soldiers, looking after their welfare, hearing their confessions. And that's what you see in the painting on the cover of the book. You see what's known as the last general absolution to the Munster Fusiliers at Rue de Bois by Fortuna Matana. You can see Father Gleeson. This is a painting of Father Gleeson, and he's given absolution to the troops, the Munster Fusiliers, actually, just before the Battle of Ober's Ridge. I think there was approximately 800 men there. And Ronan has actually been following up on that painting.
I mean, it's a very, very famous painting, but the original was destroyed.
Yes. When I wrote my book back in 2016, Wherever the Firing Line Extends, I did a chapter on it. The location at Brou de Bois has actually been found, and there's a plaque there with this painting on it. And the original painting was believed to have been destroyed in the Blitz in 1940, and that was the end of that. But I found out, discovered 2 years ago, that Mattani had painted a second version, a copy of it, in 1919 for somebody, and that painting went on sale at auction with White's 2 years ago. And I managed to track down the gentleman who bought it, and he has very kindly lent it to the Cork Museum for the 100th anniversary of the unveiling of the War Memorial in Cork. And I think this is a very much loved painting. It's been in so many, you've seen in so many people's houses over the years. It's hard to believe what I was looking at was actually the original, or as close as you're going to get, actually painted by Mattania. So I think there'll be great interest in this when it's unveiled.
Now, there are some extremely celebrated names included in this list. I suppose the most celebrated is Tom Kettle. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, Tom Kettle is, as you say, he's probably the last nationalist leader in Ireland. He was killed at the Battle of Jeanchy in September 1916. He was a poet who wrote a very famous poem, To Betty, the Gift of God, which is probably the most famous Irish poem from the First World War. He was a lawyer, university lecturer, an MP, somebody who had all the intellectual gifts to have been a leader of a post-Home Rule Ireland. Somebody who was actually an Irish nationalist to his fingertips. He was in Belgium at the outbreak of the war, trying to source guns for John Redmond, you know, John Redmond, the great constitutionist. And that was at a time when it was touch and go as to whether or not the Home Rule settlement would be accepted, and or whether Nationalist Ireland would have to fight to have it implemented. But he joined up the British war effort because he believed in the cause of small nations, and he had witnessed some of the atrocities the Germans had carried out in Belgium in 1914. And he was killed at the Battle of Jeanchy. So he's probably the most famous graduate in the book. His name is on the Tiefvall Memorial to the Missing in the Somme, so his body was never found.
And two very famous sons, I suppose you would say, both of whom survived the war. William Lombard Murphy, first of all. Who was his dad?
His father was the infamous or famous, call him what you want, William Martin Murphy, owner of the Independent newspapers, the villain of the lockouts of 1913. And again, this really illustrates the point that here is the son of one of the richest men in Ireland who has a medical practice in Merrion Square. He has everything to lose, and he joins up the war effort and spends the war in Salonika. So his father dies very quickly after the First World War, and suddenly Murphy takes over the Independent newspapers groups and his father's business empire. He dies then eventually in 1941, and he had a very, very distinguished life after the war.
William Archer Redmond, very, very famous name.
Yes, the son of John Redmond. The Redmond family are a fascinating family, as we know. So John, both John and Willie die during the war. John dies in March 1918. Willie is killed at the Battle of Messines Ridge in 1917, but William Archer survives the war. He served in the Royal Irish Regiment as well, and he becomes a TD in Waterford, and he holds that position until 1932. He's also founds a new party which holds the balance of power in the state in 1927. He eventually ends up joining Fine Gael, but he dies, like a lot of them did, suddenly in 1932 at the age of 46, and his wife Bridget inherits the seat, and she holds that seat until 1945. So, I mean, there's almost 100 years of service, public service from the Redmond family that ends with Bridget in 1945.
A name that might not be immediately familiar to people, but somebody who made a cultural contribution that will be very, very well known indeed, Arthur Colohan.
Yes, Arthur Colohan was a doctor, a sort of bit of a dilettante who ended up becoming a doctor, and he served in the war in India. He then immigrated to Leicester to work as a doctor, but he's best known as having written a lot of songs, but only one survives to this day, and that's Galway Bay. So Galway Bay was a huge hit for Bing Crosby in 1947, and obviously got a new lease of life 40 years later in the song Fairy Tale in New York, where the NYPD choir sing Galway Bay. But of course, there is no NYPD choir. But I think last year, the song was actually resurrected in New York. So it's a very famous song, Galway Bay. It was written about a brother of his who drowned in the bay. He was 19 years of age. And there's actually a plaque to Colahan in Leicester. But as far as I'm aware, there's none in his native Galway.
Well, we've been hearing the stories of some of the men and women from the National University of Ireland who took part in the First World War, including the composer of Galway Bay, Arthur Colahan. The book that we've been talking about is the NUI First World War Centenary, Roll of Honour and Essays. It's published by NUI and Four Courts Press. My guests are the editors Rona McGreevy and Emer Purcell. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks, Miles.
Thanks, Miles.
Just to hear again the ripple of the trout stream, the women in the meadows making hay, and to sit beside a turf fire in the cabin and see the sun go down on Galway Bay.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Ruth Kennington on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.